Make the Dollar Great Again. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Wednesday, the 16th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The American dollar, still the world's reserve currency, still strong, rising the past few years, even more after the election last Tuesday, and quite soon and quite possibly an economic headache for the Trump administration, because a strong dollar is going to make it that much harder for the new president to create all those factory jobs he promised. Dollar indexes, by the way, hit a 14-year high today. And with that, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going.
Listen to this headline. U.S. industrial production goes nowhere in October. That's from Michael Montgomery's latest manufacturing report. Montgomery is an economist at IHS Market. Why are U.S. factories hurting? The rising U.S. dollar.
And that's the primary reason that manufacturing has literally gone almost nowhere for the past 2 years.
The dollar got a boost after Donald Trump won the presidential election. Montgomery says it started rising during the Greek debt crisis. Now traders are betting that Trump's plans to increase infrastructure spending will give the economy a shot in the arm, boosting the dollar. Now, why would that be bad for manufacturers?
Things get more expensive because the dollar is stronger.
That's Harold Serkin, a partner of the Boston Consulting Group. He says U.S. products are priced in dollars, so a winemaker in France has to pony up more euros to buy an American-made tractor. U.S. manufacturers lose business. And Serkin says,
when your business is down, you really can't hire.
So all of Trump's promised manufacturing jobs will be harder to create. But wait, there's more.
Don't forget, the strong dollar doesn't just reduce exports, it increases imports.
The bearer of that bad news? Linda Lim, an economist at the University of Michigan. She says cheap imports make it hard for U.S. manufacturers to sell here, too. Remember that winemaker in France, the one buying a tractor? When he exports his wine to the U.S., he has an advantage because it's priced in his cheaper euros. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The energy economy got a really interesting dose of reality today, courtesy of the International Energy Agency. While renewables, yes, are growing as a share of global energy production, we are going to need oil, the IEA says, a whole lot longer than we'd been thinking. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim is on that one.
Remember peak oil? That idea that we'd start running out of the oil we'd need to match our growth?
Peak oil kind of went away after about 2008, 2009, after we had prices crash from $147
a barrel. That's Jamie Webster, a fellow at Columbia University's Center for Global Energy Policy. He says shortly after,
I'd say 2009, 2010,
the discussion changed to peak oil demand. That's the idea that with efficiency and renewables, we'll eventually need to pump less.
Not so much a question of if peak demand will happen, but rather when it will happen.
Estimates have been pushing that tipping point earlier and earlier. But then the International Energy Agency bucked trends today, releasing an estimate that pushes peak oil demand to after at least 2040. Reason? Oil's in everything.
It's plastics, it's materials, it's a whole host of things that we use that means that oil isn't just going to completely exit our economy anytime soon.
Jacques Rousseau is with Clearview Energy Partners. He says the later estimate also means oil companies can push back tough decisions, like when to cut back on exploring for oil.
This isn't a decision that is going to impact their capital investment, you know, anytime in the next 10, 15 years.
But peak demand is coming. Saudi Arabia has begun moving away from oil as its pretty much sole source of income. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Crude today, by the by, off about 0.5%, $45.57 a barrel at the close in New York. Equities, stocks, that is. A split decision. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama arrived in Berlin today, his last trip through Europe before he leaves office. In his public remarks, the president, while pointing out how he and his successor differ, the president has been trying to reassure European allies that in spite of what President-elect Trump said about NATO during the campaign, the United States is still in that alliance for the long haul, as it has been through administrations both Democratic and Republican for 70-something years. And that might be true, but there is still that oh-so-thorny question of who's going to pick up the tab. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
The coincidence was almost eerie. Just as Britain was marking Armistice Day, commemorating the dead from two world wars, the reality of Trump's victory was sinking in, and the UK was fretting about what the candidate had said during the campaign about the defence of Europe.
Our allies are not paying their fair share. The countries we are defending must pay for the cost of this defence, and if not, the US must be prepared to let these countries defend themselves.
Trump called the NATO alliance obsolete, alarming some luminaries of the British defence establishment.
People will now doubt whether America really is committed to the guarantees that it signed up to solemnly 60 or 70 years ago.
That's former National Security Advisor Lord Peter Ricketts. Nevertheless, many defence experts agree with Trump's central criticism of NATO. Independent analyst Howard Wealdon says the US bears far too much of the financial burden of the alliance.
America has been paying over 70% of NATO's costs since it was founded in April 1949. That is no longer acceptable. Europe has to pay more of its own security bill.
And he says some European countries should pay up more than others. Only the UK and Estonia hit the NATO target of spending 2% of their GDP on defence. The rest fall woefully short, says Ben Moores of IHS Market.
There's a few countries, like big-hitting countries like Germany doing 1.1, Italy doing 1.3, Spain even lower. So there is a gap.
Defence spending, who needs it? European borders are unassailable, aren't they? January 1991, the small Baltic nation of Lithuania had declared independence from the Soviet Union. Soviet forces invade. Eventually, the troops withdrew, the Soviet Union collapsed, Lithuania and the other Baltic states joined the European Union and NATO. But Russian nationalists still dream of reclaiming this and other parts of the Soviet Empire. Hardly surprising that after Putin grabbed the Crimea, there is now talk of Europe beefing up its defences. Ironically, says Ben Moores, the main beneficiary could be Europe's most reluctant military power, Germany.
If it was going to be land forces modernization, where the bulk of the money would go, the bulk of the money would go to Germany, because Germany has been the only large European country to retain a modernized and diverse vehicle manufacturing capability. So you'd be looking at armored vehicles, trucks, tanks.
No one can yet say for sure whether President Trump will turn his back on NATO and leave Europe to its own devices. But Andrew Roberts of the King's College Department of War Studies thinks we can say one thing for sure.
I do think that he is going to put a lot of pressure on NATO to just cough up.
A possible European military spending spree in the offing. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Political types will tell you that the election broke along lines of party and race and class and geography and so stipulated. Underneath all of that, though, is a little thing that around here we like to call the economy. Because even though things like white working class and Rust Belt have been the buzzy theories the past week that they're what helped Donald Trump win, the reality is more complicated because lots of working class people are people of color, and that group voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton. And parts of the Rust Belt are doing all right economically. Montgomery County, Ohio, straddles some of those racial and economic divides. It's part urban, part rural and suburban. It's multiracial with a lot of poverty and a middle class. And last Tuesday, for the first time in almost 30 years, it went Republican for president. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace talked to two women there with very different hopes for how the future is going to play out.
I met a Mexican restaurant in a northwest suburb of Dayton with Robin Pink. She's dressed for church all in red. Robin works in the packaging department at a union job at a MillerCoors brewery nearby. She makes more than $80,000 a year, and there's job security. But I'm hearing something from her that I've heard here in the Midwest, in the so-called Rust Belt, countless, countless times.
I don't know how people are making it today.
A lot of her family and friends work multiple jobs for not enough money. And in Dayton, there's a big black-white divide, too. Black people live on the west side, whites on the east, and in the suburbs where many of the jobs are. She's black, and she says in her community, there's a feeling that politicians aren't addressing the economic issues and haven't been.
When they want us to vote for them, they're all about the people then. But after that, they do absolutely nothing for the people.
She voted for Hillary Clinton, but Democratic votes for president in Montgomery County this year were down 9 percentage points. Turnout overall was low, and Donald Trump won the county with fewer votes than Mitt Romney had here in 2012. Michael Gessel with the Dayton Development Coalition is one of the people who's been trying to get jobs to come here since way before there was a Donald Trump on the scene. He says it's been a struggle.
The jobs are fewer in number. The jobs don't pay as much. And this is the critical thing. The jobs require skills.
So his organization has focused on workforce development, on the military base here, and on expanding the healthcare and education sectors. And the region has also marketed itself as a place that welcomes immigrants. An organization called Welcome Dayton has a website and does outreach to encourage immigrants to move here. Plus, there is still manufacturing, lots of high-tech small business, but the high-paying jobs you don't need a degree for?
Those jobs are gone.
Some of that is offshoring, but a lot of it is about automation. Working in a factory these days means working with more computers and robots and fewer people.
If you put 50 robots in to do 50 jobs, that's 50 people that aren't getting hired.
Kate Geiger got laid off when a GM truck plant closed here in 2008 and left with a reduced retirement. Now she also works at MillerCoors. She's actually on Robin Pink's team there. We're at her ranch house in a rural corner of the county. She's white, and she says jobs are part of why she voted for Trump, but she also wants to see the federal government shrink.
We need somebody to downsize it, and Trump's the man to do that. That's what he does.
And she says she's very worried about other issues, gun rights, crime, terrorism. Although she says she doesn't want Trump to deport millions of undocumented immigrants.
I don't think he really means that. I really don't. I think he means terrorists.
It's not just undocumented people who've been discussed in this campaign. The FBI's latest report shows a spike in hate crimes against Muslims, and Trump has promoted a policy of banning Muslims, including refugees, from entering the country. Dayton has a growing Muslim population, some of them refugees, some U.S. born. Kate says she's never known someone Muslim, but
if I were a Muslim woman, I wouldn't, and I didn't know me, I'd be scared of me.
Still, she says this vote is about morals and the economy, not religion or race. For her coworker, Robin Pink, those things can't be separated.
This country has been about race from the beginning. You know, that hasn't changed.
And she doubts Trump will lift up the economic prospects for working class people, whoever they voted for, raise wages, bring in better jobs, fix education.
Until he make that happen, they're in the same boat that I'm in.
For her family, the ones who are just scraping by, she says she just prays. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I needed the fear. I needed to be forced to rely on myself and the dream, and sometimes unemployment checks.
Anna Kendrick on being afraid. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 54 points today, 0.3%, finished at 18,868. The NASDAQ up 18 points, about 0.3%, 5294. The S&P 500 down 3, that's a 0.1%, 21.76. Mortgage demand is falling after the post-election jump in interest rates that we've been telling you about. And thus, home builders Toll Brothers fell 2%. KB Homes declined 3.7% today. Food prices are down about 2% this year. Good news for Thanksgiving shoppers, if not grocery sellers. Whole Foods off 3.6%. Kroger discounted 3 3/10 of 1%. Some hopeful news for holiday season sales. Store traffic picked up at Target after a slow summer. Target shares up 6.4% on that news. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell just a fraction. 2.21% is the yield. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Today's a two-currency show, I guess. The dollar up top, the Indian rupee now. There are a whole lot of angry people and a whole lot of confusion in India right now over the decision last week by Prime Minister Narendra Modi to get rid of the 1,500 rupee notes. The BBC's Rahul Tandon is in Calcutta. He's on the line to explain. Hello, Rahul.
Hello to you.
First of all, why is the Prime Minister doing this? What's his rationale?
Well, his rationale was to basically try and clean up India's black economy, which is absolutely huge. There are two parallel economies, and you have this huge black cash economy. So his thinking last week, when he made this dramatic announcement on television that caused panic in the next 3 or 4 hours afterwards as people went out to spend all their money or as much of it as they could, was that by replacing almost 80% of the value of India's currency, making it illegal overnight, he would get rid of most of that. It's a huge, huge gamble, political and economic, that he's taken that really, in some ways, has divided this country.
Give me a sense of I guess it's denomination here, right? 500 rupees is like $7.50 American or something. So it's like the president coming out and saying, we're going to get rid of the $20 bill or maybe the 10.
It is, but I think there's a difference. You live in an economy where if that happened, it would, of course, cause trouble to many, many people. But a lot of people have access to debit cards, to credit cards, to online payments. We're talking about an economy where that simply isn't the case. If you go to most small businesses here, most small shops where people buy their food from here in India, where they buy their vegetables, their meat and fish, they don't have access to those facilities here.
It sounds like it's regular folk who are getting hit and not necessarily the bad guys. Bad guys are going to find a way, right?
That is the case already. There's a thriving black economy at the moment where they will change our old 500 and 1,000 rupee notes, you know, for when they take about a 30% cut of this. So, of course, that is the case. And also, there are so many questions that are being asked at this particular point in time. Every day, the Prime Minister and the Finance Minister are holding press conferences trying to reassure the Indian public that, look, this is for your good and this is going to help the country. But each day they do it, they now seem to lengthen the increase of the impact. It started off that it'll be a week or two, then moved to 3 weeks. Now they're talking about 50 days. 50 days for an economy to be without the amount of cash that it needs is a huge amount of time. And remember, I'm describing to you the situation in one of India's great cities, Kolkata.
Right.
In rural India, the situation is even more desperate. You know, in some ways, people are saying that trying to take out 85% of the currency in a country of 1.3 billion people is almost an impossible task.
The BBC's Rahul Tandon. We got him in Calcutta. Rahul, thanks very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
There's a thing you do before a radio interview, or at least there's a thing that I do. I chit-chat just a little bit, a warm-up, if you will, just to ease whoever I'm talking to into it a little bit. Bear that in mind while I tell you that Anna Kendrick came in the other day. You know her from Pitch Perfect, Into the Woods, Up in the Air, Twilight, The Accountant most recently. Her new book, it's a memoir. It's called Scrappy Little Nobody. And like I said, we chit-chatted a little bit before we officially got going.
Hi.
And we're going to start exactly that way. Anna Kendrick, good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I need you to start with the part where you stole the roll of toilet paper.
Oh, boy, we're jumping right in.
We're jumping right in.
Okay.
Because it goes to what it's like to be a big Hollywood star, but really still have to work for food and rent.
Yeah, I was on the PR tour for Up in the Air, and I was kind of living that double life of, you know, somebody else is paying for the clothes that I'm wearing and the places I'm staying and the flights to get me there. And then, you know, like the proverbial Cinderella, like going back to my crappy apartment and barely being able to keep the lights on.
There was, for real.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You had a lousy little apartment. You had a couple of roommates. There were, you know, stands on the carpet.
They were great. Loved them. But I asked, like, you know, maybe the next time, like, you send me on a publicity trip to New York, mm-hmm. can I stay at, like, just a crappy hotel and I could just keep the rest of the money? Like, you're spending all this money, but none of it's going to me, and I'm a little desperate over here. And, you know, the reaction was very, oh, my goodness, we're all just so embarrassed for you that you asked us that. And so I never asked again, but I did steal a roll of toilet paper. I mean, I could afford a roll of toilet paper, but I was just losing my mind a little bit at that point. Oh, you're handing me my book now.
I want you to read that graph that I marked there in pen. I apologize for writing in your book.
Great.
Read me that paragraph.
Oh, God. You can't just cut in the audiobook?
Can't? No.
No, it's great. This is going to be great. Don't get me wrong. I wish I had more skills, but if I'd had a safety net, I would have used it. Sometimes the terror was so overwhelming that if I'd been offered an apprenticeship scrubbing the floor of a button factory, what do normal jobs look like? I would have thought, fine, I can't take this anymore. Sign me up, give me the health benefits, give me the time card, and a mean boss and some goddamn security. I needed the fear. I needed to be forced to rely on myself and the dream, and sometimes unemployment checks. Thank you, U.S. government. Please don't repossess my house when I go all Grey Gardens. Do you like how I stumbled over reading
one
sentence?
Words.
That was great.
Happens to me every
That's
day.
Charming, right? We're going to call that charming.
Do you still need the fear? I mean, here you are. I mean, you're a big, huge star now. But you learn in this book, if you read it, that you're kind of a walking, talking mass of insecurity.
Well, thank you so much.
You wrote it. I didn't. Right?
No, I think that's fair. Yeah, it's funny because I kind of vacillate between feeling like the fear is good and it should be embraced and it's something that drives me, and also feeling like, well, maybe fear-based decisions are not the way to live your life. But I don't know. I haven't found a way to suddenly be completely at ease and balanced and well-rounded and, you know, and fine with myself and my, you know, my life. So the fear does remain.
There's a line in here about how every acting job an actor gets is by definition temporary.
Yeah.
So you're hustling even as you're in the middle of, I don't know, Up in the Air or Twilight or Pitch Perfect or whatever. You're hustling for your next gig.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my whole life, I like to try to create structure wherever I can because my life is so unstructured. Mm-hmm. And so many times I tried to somehow figure out like a budget. That seems like exactly in my personality. I would be the guy who is like, everything's like budgeted and I've got a little app on my phone and whatever. You know, like TV shows are the closest that actors get to
steady
incomes.
Do you have ambition to do television?
I mean, TV is getting so incredible. Yeah. I mean, it's getting so it is incredible right now. You know, it's not something I have a plan to do because TV is like marriage. So if you're going to do it, you better be so excited about it. Yeah. And that moment hasn't come for me. There have been a couple of things, even the ones that have been, you know, very successful, you know, I still look at it and go like, that wasn't for me. Hmm. You know, I'm glad I didn't marry that show.
Do you still have any of the, I'm an outsider looking in at Hollywood and this place is just absolutely bananas?
Constantly. Yeah. Absolutely constantly. I think that's fine though. Like I definitely remember, you know, that first year, I just felt like, this is insanity. Like, we shouldn't be acting like... I mean, if you're Robert Downey Jr. and you've been in the business forever and you, like, have had your whole comeback and stuff, like, yeah, you own the city. Like, live your life. I absolutely love it. But, like, newcomers who are like, well, obviously this is where I'm supposed to be. I was like, there's something wrong with you. I don't trust you.
Ben Affleck now with The Accountant. You do a thing in Trolls. What's next?
Well, we're shooting Pitch Perfect 3 in January. And now that this book is coming out, when I meet people like you who I've never met before this moment, you'll go, oh, I know that thing happened to you.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, there's like a 5% chance that it'll make me like hole up in my house for the rest of my life.
Is there a little bit of terror in there?
There's a lot of terror. But there's always a lot of terror, and the terror is good.
It's called Scrappy Little Nobody by Anna Kendrick. You've seen her, you've seen her all over the place. Anna, thanks for coming in.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. This final note on the way out today, I have joked a couple of times on this program about how I was going to quit because I had heard of this company or that had free beer for its employees because, right? One place I am definitely not going, the Canadian brewery Labatt. The company, which I should say is now owned by AB InBev, has ended its half-century tradition of a weekly allotment of free beer for life for its retirees. How about that? All right, we got to go. The Dow off 54 points today, about 0.3%. The NASDAQ up 18 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 down 3 points, 0.1%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.